Hi folks, Wimp here. Thanks very much for hitting that download button once again. Just thought I'd very quickly introduce today's very special Tarlest End podcast. It is the first of a two-part interview with former BBC Radio Berkshire head of sport, Joel Hufford. Lots of great stories to get to from a man who covered Reading very, very closely indeed for 9 years. So lots of that to come. The first part is now, with the second part coming out on Thursday, so please stay tuned for that. Just a quick note as well to say that the main edition of the show will be back on Monday night with myself, Johnny, and maybe Westy, maybe Hammer, because I haven't even figured that one out yet. We'll be back to talk over the 2-2 draw with Fulham and get through all of your usual questions in the mailbag, so please do keep those coming in to @thetarlestend on Twitter, thetarlestend@gmail.com, and all the other usual channels. But without further ado, here is the first part of that two-part interview with myself and Joel Hufford.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlhurstend.com.
Now, if you're a Reading fan and you're sort of in your late teens, early 20s, you might not know a voice of Reading other than one Tim Deller, but I can assure you, folks, there was a man in that hot seat before Tim, and I'm delighted to be joined by the man who took it on just before Tim and taught him everything he knows, one Joel Hufford. Joel, hello, how are you?
Good evening, how are you? And it's good to be on the show, and It's good to have a chance to reminisce about years gone past.
Absolutely. Now, you were in the hot seat from, I believe, 1998 to 2007. So, really, all of the good bits. Didn't really get any bad times. Sort of left just before the relegation. Coincidence there?
Yeah, I think it's more than pure coincidence that the season after I left, unfortunately, that was when Reading went down. But some say it was just pure chance. Perhaps I had more to do with it than perhaps they let on, I don't know. But I was pretty lucky in that I came in just at the end of the Tommy Burns era, and Reading fans will be familiar with that particular period in the club's history. Lots of money spent, lots of effort put in, certainly by the manager himself, if not some of the players, but not much results on the pitch. And then we went through Alan Pardew and the success under him. And then Steve Coppell, and you know, that's when the fun really began, up into the Premiership. And if memory serves me rightly, I think we were within, and this is more Tim's calculation than mine, I was never one for stats. Stats is always Tim's department. I think we were within one goal of getting a UEFA Cup place.
Yeah, if we'd scored that winner at Blackburn.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a pretty good period in my Reading career, so to speak.
Yeah, not too bad at all. Not too bad, really. Well, we'll come on to all of the Reading goodness in just a few minutes, but let's start with yourself. How did you get into the media? Was it something you always wanted to do?
I think when I was at school, I had hankerings to be a print journalist. So I think I had visions of winning the Pulitzer Prize for breaking some big political scandal. I was always interested in sport as well. Played all sorts of different sports at school and was very much interested in that. Went to university, still with those ambitions of becoming a journalist on the print side in mind. And I got involved with student radio up at University of East Anglia. There's a station there called Livewire that has produced a number of broadcasters. I'm not the most famous one. I think Greg James from Radio 1 is probably the most famous guy who's come out of those studios.
Never heard of him.
No, indeed. So after 4 years at university, I came out and, again, I still had ambitions to work as a journalist. I changed my mind and wanted to go into broadcasting. And I had a friend who was kind of one step ahead of me with that thought process. And he did a postgraduate course in broadcast journalism. I did the same. And once you've got a piece of paper that says you can do the job, rather than knocking on people's doors and they say, well, what have you done? And you say, I've done 4 years of student radio. If you've got a certificate that says you can do it and you've got all the legal training around libel law and all that kind of stuff, then it's much easier to get a job, which I did. I started working for the BBC. I had a short stint in commercial radio as well with a small station in Bedford. And then, without wanting to swear on the podcast, I started working for BBC Radio Oxford.
Oof.
And when I turned up there, they promptly said, we don't need you here. Go down to Caversham, which is where the Radio Berkshire offices were at that stage. Because as many people may know, Radio Oxford and Radio Berkshire were kind of merged together and then they split apart in due course.
BBC Radio so Thames Valley, down, wasn't it?
Exactly, Thames Valley FM was what it was called back in the day. And when I first turned up, I was doing news journalism, and that was partly because I'd always been told at college, you need to do a few years of news before you move into sport, because otherwise people won't take you seriously. So I used to watch with envy John Southall when he was doing all his preparation for the Reading games leading up to the weekend. And then one day I overheard a conversation in the office to the effect that John had got a temporary assignment with Radio 5 Live, so he'd be disappearing off for 6 months to do that. And they needed someone to cover his spot. So I basically stuck my hand up and I ended up working with Pete Morris. So I think the first game that I ever did was Newcastle against Reading at the Mad Stad in a pre-season friendly. And I think that's when Newcastle was under Kenny Dalglish, if memory serves me rightly. And kind of went from there. I went from being essentially Pete Morris's helper to doing bits of commentary, to doing co-commentary, to taking on the sports editor role at Radio Box, which was what I was doing when I left in 2007. And obviously Tim has taken that on in leaps and bounds since then. So really, it was one of those situations where I was in the right place at the right time. But if John hadn't been moving on at that stage, or in fact, if he'd have come back after 6 months, I would have gone back into news journalism, or perhaps had to get a job somewhere else. But as it happened, John went off for 6 months and never came back. And I think to this day, he's still at Radio 5, and you can hear him on a Saturday afternoon doing match reports and all sorts on national radio.
Absolutely. Well, we'll come on to a bit more of the media game shortly, but let's switch our attentions to the pitch then. So you pitch up in 98, as you mentioned, it's the Tommy Burns era. We've just moved into Medeski Stadium. What sort of vibe was there around the club?
It was a bit of a mixed bag, because you had the new stadium and all the glamour and the comfort and the modernity that brought. But at the same time, you obviously had the fact that the product on the pitch was not fantastic. A lot of money had already been spent. I think I can remember Pete talking about the famous, seven signings on deadline day or whatever it was that came in, where I think he said the first match, everyone from people on the bench to people in the commentary box were wondering who exactly was who, because all these new faces suddenly turned up. So it was a bit of an odd atmosphere. Tommy Burns as a person was fantastic to deal with, I think, because he'd obviously, as a player and a manager, worked for Glasgow Celtic with all the scrutiny and pressure that comes with. I think by comparison, Reading was a little bit of a walk in the park. He was absolutely taking the job seriously, but in terms of dealing with the media, he was a lot more relaxed than, say, Alan Pardew was when he initially turned up. And the players, again, they were a bit of a mixed bag. The more experienced ones were quite easy to deal with. But I think because there was quite a lot of disharmony in the camp, some of that came out in some of their behaviour towards the media. So I can remember the likes of Darren Caskey never being particularly friendly. In contrast, Nicky Forster was always very good and would always give you an interview. And I can always remember, I actually got to know him a little bit after he quit playing, and he was still living in Reading, but when he was working as a scout for the likes of Blackburn and then Liverpool, Barry Hunter. But he could be a bit of a one at the training ground. When you were trying to do an interview, he'd be pinging balls at you from 100 yards away. And sadly for us, he was remarkably accurate. So it could be a bit tricky at times, but I think the main thing was it was obvious that it wasn't a happy camp, and that something needed to change relatively quickly, which it obviously did with Mr. Burns and Mr. Bonner packing their bags and Alan Pardew, of all people, coming in.
Can you remember who your first interview was of a Reading player or staff member? Was it Burns?
I think probably the first person that I spoke to in terms of an interview was Tommy Burns. And obviously at that stage, it was the start of pre-season. There was still optimism around the place, but you could tell just from the rumblings that were kind of going on from the fans that we spoke to, that it was very much a case of they wanted to see the proof in the pudding. All this money had been spent. And again, I've already sworn once mentioning Oxford, but I know a lot of people will talk about, was it Sean Evers?
Yes, from Luton.
£1 million from Luton. I'm not entirely sure who scouted him, but it was obvious to a blind man on a galloping horse that he wasn't going to be the player everyone thought he was going to be. And that's no disrespect to him, because I'm sure he was doing his best. It's just when you saw him in training and you saw him on the pitch, unfortunately, it didn't seem to happen for him.
He had a load of hype, and I remember he was always good on Championship Manager. So I've always wondered if someone just picked up a copy of that and signed him off the back of that, because he certainly didn't produce it in real life. Did you get to interview Massar during his time?
Yeah, Massar was there. I think when I turned up, he had yet another injury, and I think he played a handful of games and then had another injury, and then I think he had some family issues, which meant he had to go back to New York, Liberia? Where I think his family was most of the time. So, yeah, so Massar was an interesting one. So, again, when he was in a good mood, he was great to deal with. When he wasn't in a good mood, you tended to stay away from him because he made it obvious that he didn't want to give you the time of day. But he was an interesting character, and you have to admire someone who's gone from Liberia to where it was Hajduk Split in the former Yugoslavia, where I think Tommy Burns picked him up from, and there were rumours going around that he'd only seen him ever in a scouting video. And this was obviously back in the days where it was literally VHS cassettes as opposed to anything that was available online. But again, it was really that slightly cosmopolitan on the face of its squad, because you had the likes of Elroy Crom here.
Yep.
Dutch player who was there. I think you had all the Scottish contingent in there as well, as I guess you would naturally expect with Tommy Burns and his Scottish connection. But it was just obvious to me, both on the training ground and on the pitch, that they weren't gelling, and obviously those splits were being exacerbated by the fact the results weren't coming, despite everyone's best efforts and all the money that was being spent and the pressure that was building up as a result.
Yeah, and Sir John Medeski was away at the time as well, I think, wasn't he? Was he in Malaysia? Off for a year for financial reasons, we'll describe it.
Yes. So he was setting up Auto Trader in the Far East, and I think also as well, the rumour always was that it was to do with tax reasons in terms of needing to be out of the country for a certain specified amount of time. I'm not sure if we ever clarified that with him, but I can remember the day that he came back into the country, there was this big scramble in the office because we got wind that he was back, and miraculously, seemingly, we got an interview with him straight away. So for me, having not met him previously, it was quite an exciting day. And again, Mr. Medeski, people have their different views on him. From my point of view, he was always very easy to deal with. He never ducked an interview. And generally, he never ducked a difficult question in an interview as well. And certainly, particularly when they were celebrating when we had the promotion, both the one that came off the back of the draw with Brentford and also the one that came to get into the Premiership, he was always very good value for a live interview on the radio. Normally, because by the time we got to him, he'd had a chance to celebrate already. So he was normally quite well warmed up by the time we got to him.
Yeah, I've long had my suspicions of a fair few interviews I've seen of him. Let's just say he might have had a drink or two. Yes. I can't confirm nor deny these things, but that's my impression.
At Griffin Park, he had a champagne bottle in his hand. I'm almost certain of it.
Well, we'll leave that one there. So you mentioned that promotion against Brentford. That came off the back of Alan Pardew taking over. As you mentioned, Tommy was sacked early in the 1999-2000 season. Alan came in, slowly turned the club around, but by the end of the next season, he had Butler and Cureton up front, and we're on our way to Cardiff. What was covering that run to the playoffs like? And as well as that day in Cardiff itself, the night that always sticks out for me in that season is that 2-1 win over Wigan in the semi-finals. Was that one of the best nights at the stadium for you?
I think that's probably my favourite Reading commentary. I mean, it's certainly one of the best evenings at the Medeski Stadium, but I think it's probably one of my favourite games to have commentated on, along with the playoff final, simply because from an emotional point of view, it was so visceral. It was so up and down. One minute things were not going our way, then Nicky Forster comes on and we score two goals in, a matter of minutes, seemingly. You had, I can't remember whether the pitch invasion came after the first or the second goal or both, but you then had the pitch invasion, which then meant they had to bring out police horses, police dogs, all sorts of, officers coming onto the pitch to clear it. I think it was just a turnaround that up until relatively late in the game, it looked like it was all over. And then Nicky Forster, who'd been out, I think, injured for quite a lot of the season, came on and seemed to turn the tide. And I can always remember, I'm not sure if he took the penalty or whether he just scored the rebound off the save.
Yeah, I think Kieran, but I could always remember him.
That's right. I could always remember him sweeping it in and then disappearing off towards the corner flag between the north stand and the east stand and being mobbed from there. But that's probably the best game in terms of turnaround in fortunes and just, enjoyment from that point of view. And then you kind of almost have the polar opposite with the game against Walsall at the Millennium Stadium. You had this long build-up to it. You had everyone in the stadium, but, it was great support from Walsall. You had all the Walsall fans with the Don Goodman afro wigs on as well, sort of adding to the atmosphere. You had all the Reading fans in. the absolutely most appalling pitch I've ever seen in my time as a commentator was at the Millennium Stadium. Because really? In the early days, they seemed to have issues with the pitch, and it was all over the shop. And again, it was one of those situations where Walsall got the upper hand, and no matter what Reading seemed to do, they couldn't get back into it. And then sort of Darren Byford, I think as Pete put it, kind of applied the coup de grace and sort of got the goal that sort of finished things off. But I think it was just, at the end of it, the thing that stood out for me was we packed up all our stuff and we all crammed into this little BBC branded car and drove all the way back down the M4 to Reading. And it was just a sense of disappointment in the car. And I'm sure that could only be increased by the power of many millions on the team coach and in the fans convoy as well. Just the disappointment of getting nothing out of the season, that ultimately you'd had all this effort, all this build up, and it had come to nothing. And I know that's part of the beauty and the emotion involved in the playoffs, but I think it was just that sense of disappointment I was really struck by. And I wonder now, thinking about it, how much effect that had on the players and the management for the following season in terms of making sure that they avoided that. Although when they did eventually get up with that Cureton goal, getting the draw at Brentford, I can remember, I think they drew something like the last 10 or 11 games. Yeah. I mean, at one point, I can remember we were at Tranmere and it was the weekend that Brighton got they got automatic promotion. I think they might have even got the championship that weekend. We were 2-0 down against Tranmere, who'd been nowhere during the season. And we thought, well, this is going to set the seal on it. We're going to be pushed into the playoffs and never get back out into the automatic promotion zone. And I think Tony Rougier popped up with a goal and someone else did. We ended up getting a 2-2 draw. But I can remember thinking, 10 or 11 draws, if you think about that, that's 22 drop points.
Yeah.
Or, 10 or 11 gain points. But you think about how much easier it could have been going to Griffin Park. But then you think about it, well, actually, would you have liked to have had an easy finish and got automatic promotion weeks before the end of the season? Or would you have rather have gone to that, almost the last knockings of it? And even then being 1-0 down to a Lloyd Owusu goal. And then Jamie Cureton, it wasn't just one of these things where he belted it from 30 yards and it hit someone's backside and went in. If you look back on it, it takes a huge amount of courage to lob the keeper. And even then, either Inga Marson, which I didn't realise until later at the time, the defender almost scrambled it back out off the line again. And again, it wasn't until I looked back at the video on YouTube a few years ago, I realised that either Inga Marson was in the Brentford team and also Steve Stilwell. It's one of those funny things, you don't realise it at the time, and then obviously they popped up and played a massive role in the next stage of history for Reading Football Club, going from the Football League up into the Premiership.
What were the celebrations like?
I think that's probably my career highlight, is being on the pitch with the players when they celebrated. We had what's called a radio mic, so basically a microphone that has no lead, so you can kind of wander wherever you like within reason. I was quite lucky because at Griffin Park, it's a very small, old-fashioned ground. So when it became obvious that Reading might actually do it, I made my way down to the touchline. En route, I narrowly avoided getting grabbed and beaten up by some drunk Brentford fans, who I then think made it onto the pitch. And I think Phil Parkinson, of all people, saw them off with a couple of...
That does not surprise me, choice words. Phil.
Yeah, a couple of choice words and possibly a little bit of physical persuasion as well. So it went from, the turn of a coin almost, that 50-50 chance that if I'd been a few seconds later down the stairs, they might have blocked my way and, beat me up or whatever it was, and I'd have ended up with no teeth rather than being on the pitch celebrating. The steward I had a word with, thankfully, he could see that I was media, and I think because he was relatively junior, he wasn't worrying too much about the rules. When the final whistle went, I just ran onto the pitch, and I had no idea who I would come across first. I obviously had an idea of what questions I would ask and all that kind of stuff, but really it was just find someone with a Reading shirt on and get talking to them. And I can remember I bumped into Sammy Igoe, first of all. So little Sammy. And I kind of made it, I did my Davina McCall bit. So on Big Brother, she always says, you're live, i.e. don't swear on national television. So I said to Sammy, you're promoted, well done, you're live on BBC Radio Berkshire, brackets, please don't swear. And I could see in his own mind, he was thinking, right, I've got to not swear, So we had this little chat, and then all he could, I could see he was bursting to say it, and all he said was, "We're effing going up." So I thought at that stage, okay, thanks, Sammy. And I moved on, which I would have done anyway, but I thought, given that he'd obviously just had a bit of a potty mouth moment, I better move on. And then I went around all sorts of different people. The one person I never got to was Alan Pardew, because I think he went straight back into the dressing room. I think probably from his point of view, because it was a massive moment of vindication after all the stick that he'd taken initially when he turned up.
He nearly got sacked, hadn't he, earlier that season? I remember we lost at home to Swindon and people were saying maybe he should go.
Yeah. So he'd obviously had his first season where he was under a massive amount of pressure. He'd actually had a big turnaround, particularly with Martin Allen coming on board. Then obviously the season when we got promoted at Griffin Park, I think Martin Allen had gone and Kevin Dillon had come in as his assistant. So there was that kind of trauma to take into account as well. So I got round a whole load of players. I think the ones that stand out for me, Adi Vivash, he'd had a lot of issues with, I think, the health of his children in particular. I think he'd also possibly lost his dad as well. So I can remember him when we were talking, almost talking to his mum, because I think he knew his mum would be listening. So he was talking to her. And in fact, afterwards, he was the inspiration for doing a kind of CD of the day, because he said, well, can I have a CD of the interview? Because I want to remind my mum about what I said. And we ended up turning that into a CD that we sold for charity and what have you, and which I've still got copies of at home and occasionally listen to for a spot of nostalgia. But it was just one of those, you at the time, I did appreciate it was probably a once-in-a-lifetime moment, because I know Tim had the same with the Reading players who got Reading into the Premiership on the pitch at the Walker Stadium when they went up at Leicester City. I guess Griffin Park was my equivalent of that, where you just have this unique moment where you are almost part of the team. So there was John Modesky that I spoke to, Ron Grant, the kit man, was there was Phil Parkinson, there was Adi Williams, there was Adi Vivash. Andy Hughes was running around like a kid who'd had too much Coke and chocolate, Coke as in the soft drink.
Yeah, we'll clarify that.
randomly came up and shouted at me a lot, which was, you know, his way, because he was very, a very excitable character. So there were a whole host of people that I spoke to. Martin Butler spoke very well. I think John Sulaco said it was the best football day of his career, and I kind of qualified it with him and said, what, better than playing for England? And he said, yeah, right now, this is better than anything I've ever experienced. And Jamie Cureton, understandably, he was very emotional as well, because I think he'd had his injury problems throughout the season, so he'd come in and out of the team. And in fact, I don't think he'd started that game.
No, he came on as a sub.
So again, I think he felt a certain amount of vindication. And then in terms of the celebrations, we all packed up, headed back to Reading. And I think in my naivety at the time, I just kind of thought, well, that's it. And I went out and just had some drinks with some friends in town, whereas I didn't realise that the party was going on at the Modesky Stadium. So from what I gather, I think the team bus turned up at the Mad Stand.
Yeah.
John Mackey, who hadn't even been playing, he'd been out injured. But I can remember talking to him again. I think like John Modesky, they'd both been having a drink or two during the match. So by the time they got to the celebration, they were well away. And I think the coach turned up at the area where the team entrance is at the stadium, and John was on the roof of the coach. So I'm not sure how it stood from a health and safety point of view, but certainly memorable celebrations all round. And, like I said, that's probably my highlight of my Reading FC broadcasting career, probably one of the highlights of my life, because it was like being part of the team. And in many ways, we felt like we'd been through the same kind of emotions throughout the season, particularly with the 10 or 11 draws and what have you. But again, a unique moment in my broadcasting career and in my life as well.
Absolutely. Well, we go up to Division One under Alan. We then get to the playoffs again, have that game at Wolves where Nicky Forster goes off injured and it all sort of collapses. Then Alan leaves for West Ham. You're obviously in the thick of this, trying to cover the story. Was it harder for you? Obviously, you have those relationships with the managers. Is it hard to then cover a story like that when the manager leaves and there's all this animosity? Did you feel that towards Alan at the same time, or could you see his point of view?
I don't think I ever had any animosity towards him. Out of all the managers that I dealt with, and in contrast to Tim, where there's been a bit more of a revolving door during his time, with Alan, out of all those three managers that I dealt with, he was probably the one that I had the least warm relationship with. We got off to a bit of a shaky start when he first turned up, because when I first turned up, I asked him some quite pointed questions about the questions that were being asked by the fans about was he the right man for the job. So I think he started off with a bit of a chip on his shoulder about that, because I was the kind of guy who was expressing a lot of the noise that was in the system around him. He was quite defensive about that. And so he was always quite standoffish with me. I had to admire him from a football coaching point of view, because, you know, when you look at taking the Tommy Burns squad and what he'd done with it and how he'd built it from there and got the promotion at Griffin Park and then got within, you know, getting to the playoff final again in Division One up against, a strong Wolves side, you had to admire him from that point of view. And when I first heard the rumours about West Ham, because I think at the time Reading were flying and West Ham were sort of struggling in the midst
of the table.
Yeah, Division One. I kind of wondered, I thought, why would you want to go to West Ham? And then obviously the penny dropped in terms of more money, very possibly, you know, a bigger club in terms of profile, and perhaps, you know, again, the challenge of starting from a low ebb and building it up from there. Perhaps that's something that he relished. But I can remember we heard that he was on his way out, that he was having this meeting with the chairman at the stadium. So I went up to the stadium and basically stationed myself outside where the hotel car park was. And sure enough, he emerged and I had a quick word with him. And all he would say was, I can't say anything, but there'll be something given out to my agent, to the Press Association, which then puts it on the news wires and we and other news outlets can pick it up. And when he said that, I knew that he was going. So I just phoned back to the studio and said, this is what he's told me. I'm pretty sure that he's going. And we kind of went from there. But I can always remember the evening post photographer was lurking outside as well and kind of ambushed him. And in Alan's hurry to get away, he had a nice BMW 5 Series, which I think was a company car. He managed to quite badly curb his front wheel. Oh. So when he handed the car back, it probably had a large dent in it from trying to get out the Medeski Stadium car park too quickly and avoid the Evening Post photographer. But again, we didn't really get a chance to clarify it with him and such, but the rumour always was that it was a relatively minor issue that caused the falling out and kind of led to him going from there. I don't know all the details, the ins and outs of it, but certainly, you know, I think from my point of view, I don't blame him for going. If I was offered more money with a bigger organisation and perhaps, you know, a challenge to get your teeth into, and perhaps he wasn't feeling as much love as he would like from the likes of John Medeski and Nigel Howe and other people, that's perhaps why he wanted to go. But at the time, I couldn't quite understand why you would leave a team that you'd established and that was flying for a club that were struggling lower down the division. But I guess, you know, it may have been the whole prestige money thing that came into play.
Well, for him, it's certainly been vindicated. Obviously, he's had great success, and there we'll be seeing him at the Medeski very soon for a quarter final. So, Alan goes. You mentioned Kevin Dinnell has a brief spell as caretaker manager. Steve Coppell comes in. What were your initial impressions of Steve Coppell? And did you sort of foresee the situation? Did you think the Reading had peaked when Steve came in? Or could you see them going from strength to strength and obviously ended up in the Premier League?
I don't think anyone could honestly say they foresaw the transformation that he brought about. I obviously only really knew Steve from briefly when he was, in his playing days at Man United before he had his injury problems. And then I really remember him when he was Crystal Palace manager, when they obviously got to the FA Cup final in 1990 or whenever it was, when Pardew was playing. So I can remember when Steve Coppell kind of came on board, there was obviously a lot of that comparison about the fact that, you know, he had that Crystal Palace connection. Him and Pardew had obviously worked together as player and manager, respectively as well. But he came with a very good pedigree. He'd obviously been in charge of that Brentford team that got almost promoted ahead of Reading in that season when Reading did get promoted. But he was a very different character from Alan Pardew. Alan Pardew could be quite waspish, quite aggressive at times, in the sense of aggressive in being defensive, if that makes any sense. You'd ask him a relatively banal question with no edge to it, and he would get the hump about it. There were times when, you know, not so much myself, but I can remember Nick Eye from the Evening Post got banned from the training ground because of a story that he'd run, which I found always quite childish and quite silly. With Steve, he was a complete contrast. You could ask him anything. He wouldn't take offence at anything. He understood the game. I don't think he particularly liked doing the media stuff, but I think he liked building a relationship with the local guys. So the likes of myself, Nick Ive from the Evening Post, and Ben from Radio 210 when they used to do Reading commentary as well. And I think he liked the fact that for Radio Berkshire, because we had quite a long sports show on a Saturday, we liked to do different things. So we would ask him stuff that had nothing to do with football. So I can remember one of the best interviews I did with him was when I talked to him about what his favourite food was. And he said egg and chips. And I said, well, egg and chips, that's not a particularly exotic meal. And he'd started to talk about the fact that it was what his mum used to cook for him on a Saturday afternoon after he got back from either watching or playing football. And he started to talk about his family life and that kind of stuff. So he was really easy to deal with. And I think he was the kind of guy that he was hungry for success, but I don't think it defined him. I think it was the journey that defined him. And he just was a joy to deal with because he was so relaxed, never got the hump with you, never got upset with you. And I think that is why his management style worked, in that he was strong enough that people respected him, but he gave people enough, you know, independence and enough freedom to do what they needed to do. And just was, you know, a very positive coach, as opposed to the Alex Ferguson hairdryer type of coach, you know, the vast majority of the time.
So he mentioned his style and transforming the team around, but it didn't go sort of to plan the first sort of season and a half he was there. We missed out on the playoffs both those times. He comes into the 2005-06 season. They make that big statement, signing with Leroy Lee to the first £1 million player to come into Reading. But going into that season, did you have any sort of suspicions of what was to come?
Not at all. Again, like you say, the sort of, you know, the preceding couple of seasons build up to it. They'd kind of been there or thereabouts, but it hadn't quite happened. There was the Leroy Lita thing. But looking back, when I was doing a little bit of research, just to kind of remind myself about some of the key facts and figures, it's kind of Kevin Doyle and Shane Long, who almost crept under the radar. They were these kind of nice-to-have signings, it seemed at the time, coming in from, I think it was Cork City, where they both came in from the Republic of Ireland. And little did we know what effects they would have. If you look back at the stats, you've got Doyle there, who's the joint top league scorer alongside Dave Kitson with 18 goals in the league. And even Shane Long, he kind of came in with his moments every now and again along the way. And if you look at him now, of that generation of Reading players who made it into the Premiership, and then went their different ways. So the likes of Sidwell going to Chelsea, and then with Kitson and Sonko, and even Glenn Little going off to other clubs. It's only really Shane Long of those group of players who's endured and obviously went to West Brom, and now he's kind of had a bit of a revival at Southampton. He's one of their key players. But at the time, I don't think we had any idea what was going to happen, particularly because I think the start of the season was a game against Plymouth where we dominated and lost. But then you look back on all the results that follow after that, and on paper, it all looked swimmingly easy. And I think in many ways it was, but I don't think we realised just how special it was. But I think, as with all the great teams, it comes from having a spine of players that gives you that consistency. So you had the likes of Hanneman in goal, you had Sonko and Ingemarsson at the back, you had Sidwell in midfield, you had the combination of Doyle, Lita, Kitson up front, and then you had other players like Glenn Little, John Oster to a certain extent, who made big contributions in midfield. You had Graham Mercy, very solid at full-back, along with Nicky Shorey, and the special skills that he brought from dead ball situations. And it just kind of seemed to snowball and generate that momentum of itself. And, you know, by the end of it, I don't think anyone was surprised that Reading got the record of 106 points in a season. And I can remember, obviously, the day at Leicester was memorable with the draw, again, that got the promotion that we needed. But it was then when we came back to the Mad Stad, and you kind of thought, well, you know, rest of the season is going to be a bit of a after the Lord Mayor's parade. And I think we gave Derby a bit of a going over. Then there was the pitch invasion and all that kind of business. Again, in my time, I'd never seen anything like that, other than obviously the scenes that we'd had during the Wigan playoff semi-final. But to see the pitch literally filled with people, and just a sea of people underneath the West Stand after the players had gone in, it was a magical thing. So again, I just feel very privileged that during my time, I had the Griffin Park day to experience. We obviously previously had the highs and lows of the playoffs getting to the Cardiff final against Walsall as well, in kind of contrast. And then to get into the Premiership, and for me to experience a season in the Premiership and to go to the likes of Old Trafford, the Emirates, all sorts of other different stadia as a Premiership team, that was fantastic.
Can you remember the point in that promotion season where you thought they're going to do this? Was there a particular game or a moment?
I'm not sure if there was a particular tipping point where I kind of thought this is it. Because I think even with when it got to Leicester and we got the draw that we needed, there's obviously a risk that if we'd have got beaten, it would have dragged on again. I think because I'd experienced the 10 or 11 draws leading up to the Griffin Park day, I kind of wasn't counting my chickens too much. So you could see that the team were banging form, but there was always that doubt in my mind about, let's just take it one game at a time, because there is a danger that if you kind of think you're over the line, you'll kind of get pipped, sort of thing. And I think also as well, the games were coming so thick and fast and the team were doing so well. And as a result of that, they were getting so much attention. I think we were so busy dealing with all that kind of stuff rather than thinking any further afield. I think for me, until it actually happened at Leicester, I didn't actually quite believe it. And even then, it was really hard to get my head around. And again, I can remember driving back from Leicester and we bumped into Graham Murty's wife on the ring road on the outskirts of Leicester and had a quick chat with her whilst we were waiting at some lights. And then I can remember driving back to Caversham and Andrew Peach had done a special program when we'd gone off air at 6 and he'd taken over and essentially done a celebration program through until 10 o'clock or so. So I think it wasn't until we got back and we contributed to the end of that show and we heard some of the highlights of what people have been doing in Reading and the surrounding area since the promotion had been clinched that it kind of became real to me, because we'd kind of done the game, we'd had all the post-match interviews and stuff, we'd wrapped up, we got in the car and we got home, and then when we got a chance to get home and have a breather, that's when it really sunk in for me.
Did much around the club change that promotion to the Premier League? Did you notice much around the club sort of change from obviously stepping in when they're in the third tier, really?
The only thing that really changed was the press conferences, the number of people who turned up got absolutely massive. So, for example, whereas at one stage, when it was in the Tommy Burns, Alan Pardew early days, it'd just be me and Nick Ive from the Reading Evening Post, Anthony Smith from the Reading Chronicle, as it was then, and possibly Ben from Radio 210 if he had the chance to come out of the studio and get some interviews. And then you contrast that with the early Premiership days, and particularly after the time that we signed Song Ki-hyun, the Korean player, you'd obviously get the local media turn up, but that would inevitably include photographers who had previously come down to get training shots and stuff. You get Meridian TV and BBC South turning up religiously every week rather than every now and then, because Reading were the big story in the region all of a sudden. You obviously got all the national press that turned up because it was the Premiership, and whereas they weren't really interested in the Championship unless it was a special story or towards the end of the season, they wouldn't turn up. They all turned up. You had Sky TV turned up. And then you had TV stations and reporters from the Middle East, from the Far East, from America turning up. And like I said, when we signed Song Ki-hyun, at one stage, I think we had 6 film crews from Korean TV stations turned up because he was such a personality back in South Korea. So that was the main thing that changed. But the good thing was, because we had a good relationship, not only with the press team, who kind of knew that we'd been there through thick and thin and would always be, and with the players and the management, we still got extra freedom to do interviews and get our time with them. And it was only really in the second season, the Premiership, that I can remember that things started to change. And we would phone players up, as we always had done, directly on their mobiles. And they would say, sorry, I can't talk to you. We've been told you have to go via the press office. And that's kind of when it started to change a little bit and it got a bit more corporate and a bit more Premiership. And I completely understand the club's point of view from that, because they wanted to have more control over things, and they're also looking after their own interests in terms of they wanted to have a lot of exclusive content themselves for their Reading FC TV platform that they were rolling out and all that kind of stuff. So I think for me, I probably had an easier time than perhaps Tim has in many ways, because I think since I left, the media operation at the football club, I think as it has done at most football clubs, it's got a lot more switched on, a lot more professional, a lot more about, okay, we've got content that we can create, that we can make money out of. Therefore, they're going to sort of limit more what you can do with the outside media, where they're not perhaps going to get the direct income from it. So that was the main thing that really changed. In terms of the management and the players and the atmosphere around the club, it was happy, it was relaxed. I think that's why they had so much success in the opening season, because it was a kind of journey of, we're going to enjoy this a game at a time. And actually, through that attitude, they got quite a lot of success. And as we were saying before we got started, came within a goal of getting to into the European places. So really, it didn't really change that much. And I think to a certain extent, from what I can see reading between the lines, I think when they got relegated again a season or so later, or a couple of seasons later, I think, you know, the sort of more homely atmosphere kind of came back into it a little bit, as things got a lot more relaxed, and there wasn't the pressure of servicing all these different media appetite kind of thing.
Yeah, who was your favourite player from that sort of, from that 106 team? Who for you was the driving force?
There's so many. I think if there was one player I had to pick out, it would probably be Ibrahima Sonko, just in terms of a talisman. I think without him, I think in many ways it wouldn't have been the team that it was. So Marcus Hanneman was great in goal. The back four worked well as a unit. Nicky Shorey, as we've seen, because he got picked up by Premiership clubs subsequently, although never really established himself, was a big talent. You had the likes of Glenn Little, who was very entertaining. And you had, obviously, you had Leiter, Kitson and Doyle up front, all getting goals in their own different ways. But for me, Ibrahima Sonko, he was the rock that everything was built on. And I can remember, I think it was in the 106 season, I'm trying to remember when it was, we went down to St Mary's to play Southampton, and for me, Sonko was the deciding factor in the game. He was so strong defensively.
Was that massive header?
Yes. So there's a photo of him jumping above, I think it's Darren Powell, who was playing for Southampton at the time, who's not a small guy by any stretch of the imagination. And if you can imagine Powell's head, and Sonko is jumping so high that his kind of midriff is about the same level as Powell's head. That's the kind of photo that sums up Sonko for me. And in many ways, that season, if it was that season, just because he was so solid at the back, and it kind of contrasted with the kind of how tough and hard he was on the pitch with how he was off the pitch. He was this very softly spoken guy with a sort of French accent. In many ways, he was almost kind of camp in his demeanour. He was very softly spoken, and kind of the only way I can describe it is almost camp in the way that he was. But on the pitch, he was an absolute phenomenon. He was just solid as a rock, strong, tough, not dirty at all, you know, fair in the tackle and everything like that. But for me, he was the player that really stands out as being the key for Reading throughout his time there. And it's just a shame for me that he obviously had those issues when he had that serious knee injury, and he came back from that and he played for the likes of Stoke and never really got established. Played for Hull, I think, never got established. Ipswich, kind of the same. And I think Portsmouth as well. And never really got established again in the same way. And that was a shame for me, that a lot of the Reading players of that generation, apart from Shane Long now, went elsewhere, went to other Premiership clubs, and then kind of slid back down or kind of faded away. So for me, that was a bit of a shame, but I guess at least they've had that chance to have that magic moment with Reading and then to experience, you know, the rest of their time with other clubs.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.
Right, we're going to take a pause there and we'll bring you the rest of the interview a little later this week. It's very much worth sticking around for, as Joel takes his thought on the club as it is now, his views on Tim Deller and why he's such a polarising figure, plus his best ground he worked at, his worst ground to visit, and who was his favourite interview, and who was the one player that he never really liked
to talk to. So all of that and much, much more coming up in part two later this week. Thanks again to Joel. As I said, please stay tuned for that second part later this week.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.